Welcome to Talk Poverty Radio on the We Act Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis. Happy Labor Day! When Congress returns from recess after we've all put away our barbecues, Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton will introduce legislation prohibiting employers from asking job applicants for their salary history. The bill comes on the heels of similar legislation recently signed into law in Massachusetts. Both seek to eliminate the wage gap that continues to depress wages and earning potential for women and workers of color. With me to discuss these and other efforts to secure equal pay for equal work is Jocelyn Fry. She's a senior fellow with the Women's Initiative at the Center for American Progress and former deputy assistant to President Obama and director of policy for First Lady Michelle Obama. Jocelyn, thank you so much for joining Talk Poverty Radio.
Well, thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
And happy Labor Day.
Well, thank you, and same to you.
I hope your barbecue is still out while we're talking.
I'm still savoring the last little bit.
Oh, good. Well, just to kick us off, how does asking about salary history contribute to the wage gap? Play this out for me. You're a worker looking for a job. You apply for a job. How does this come into play?
Well, what happens is that women and people of color generally earn less than their white male counterparts in particular. So if you have a woman who is already earning less than the man sitting next to her, and the employer is allowed to ask about their prior salary, then that employer is able to say, well, I can only give you a 10% raise or a 20% raise, and the last salary becomes the baseline that is used to set the salary for a new position. So a person who's already earning less and perhaps experiencing discrimination is locked into that prior salary. So this sort of addresses that problem and makes sure that employers aren't essentially offering low salaries or hitching their salaries to prior salaries that could be infected with discrimination.
Now, our listeners may be familiar, as I think probably most people are, with the 79-cent statistic that the average woman earns 79 cents on the dollar compared to the average man. But less well known and getting less in the way of visibility is Black Women's Equal Pay Day and the Black Women's Pay Gap. What is the state of the pay gap for women of color today in 2016?
Well, there's a lot of variation, but I'm glad that you asked that because, as you said, the 79 cents is the well-known number. But African-American women earn, on average, these are full-time workers working year-round, only 60 cents compared to their white male counterparts. And if you look at Latinas, it's 55 cents, and American Indian women, it's 59 cents. So, you know, many women of color are earning even less than their white female counterparts when it comes to their year-round earnings.
So what is the significance, getting back to the Norton bill being introduced when Congress comes back from Labor Day, what is the significance of this legislation and what impact would it have on closing the pay gap for women and workers of color?
Well, I think it needs to be understood in context. And, you know, Delegate Norton and Congresswoman DeLauro have been leaders on this front for many, many years. And so salary history is one piece of the puzzle. It's not a panacea. You know, it's not going to fix a problem entirely, but it's an effort to target a particular practice that can perpetuate discrimination and simply say that employers ought to be setting salaries based on what the job is worth and not what a prior employer may have said, because that prior salary could have been depressed artificially for a variety of reasons. So this helps reduce discrimination that can be aimed at Black women, but really all workers. But I think what's important to understand is that If you look at places like Massachusetts, where they've had recent legislation, and even what Ms. Norton and Congresswoman DeLauro have done on this in this space generally, that salary history is one piece of a broader swath of reforms that are really needed to make sure that people are paid fairly, that they don't face pay discrimination in the workplace, and that we actually begin to close the wage gap.
So how does this new federal legislation compare to the Massachusetts law?
Well, that's a great question, because the bill, and, you know, as you said, Delegate Norton is going to be dropping this bill after Labor Day, so we'll have to look at it more closely. But just based on what how it's described, that bill is really focused on salary history and limiting the ability of employers to ask about salary history when they're hiring somebody. The Massachusetts bill is really a much more comprehensive effort. It had a similar provision around salary history, but it also did a bunch of other things. It made sure that people were not being paid unfairly for work that was comparable. It includes some provisions around pay secrecy to make sure that people can talk about their pay and not be retaliated against. It includes some provisions that limit the ability of employers to simply decide not to hire somebody for reasons that are not job related or connected to their business necessity. So the Massachusetts bill is a much more comprehensive effort to attack pay disparities and pay discrimination in a variety of different ways.
Now, Eleanor Holmes Norton was the first woman to chair the EEOC, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, and she herself is a woman of color and often speaks about having encountered discrimination in the workplace, both on grounds of her gender and on grounds of her race. You also are a woman of color. Have you experienced the pay gap personally or seen colleagues or coworkers who have?
You know, again, a great question. I mean, part of the challenge with pay discrimination is you don't really know, right? I mean, you often don't know what somebody is earning sitting next to you, and you can surmise and suspect it, but you don't really have a good answer. Now, I have been fortunate that in some of my positions, you mentioned that I was in the administration, that, you know, salaries are public. So I was able to see what other people earn, and was fortunate that I was being paid comparably to other colleagues. But I certainly know of people who have encountered a very different story and often find out by surprise or happen to hear somebody who just got hired and it turns out they earn $10,000 more than what they earn. So I think that's the challenge here with pay discrimination, is that we have such a culture of secrecy around salaries generally that it's often really difficult to know whether or not you're being paid equally or if you're experiencing some sort of pay disparity.
So now, just putting my devil's advocate hat on for a moment, some might raise concerns with whether this kind of a policy is really administrable. And the question might then continue to say, well, if you aren't going to allow employers to ask about salary history, what's the alternative? How else are they going to set salaries and figure out what people are worth? How would you respond to those kinds of questions and concerns?
Well, I think that at the end of the day, employers ought to be setting salaries based on what they think the value of the job is and the position that they have to offer. And, you know, part of this policy strategy is to get away from using factors that really ought not to be relevant to your salary decision. You know, whether or not a prior employer decided to pay somebody a particular salary in a completely different set of circumstances is of questionable relevance to how you decide to pay your employees. So I think there's simply a difference of opinion about whether or not that information is relevant at all. And the way that the Massachusetts bill works, it's not that you can never get that information. It's about when you can get the information. What you can't do is ask salary information and use that as a decider of whether or not you're going to hire somebody or how much you're going to pay them. Now, on the back end, if you need, you know, information to sort of confirm that the person has sort of told you accurately, you can get information later. But this is a question about how do you make decisions about whether or not to hire somebody and make decisions about how you want to pay people. And the whole point is that you should be valuing the job on its own merits and not because, you know, this is what I think this person's worth versus another person who might have the same skills but simply a different race or gender.
So the Massachusetts policy has become law, as you mentioned. Now the federal legislation will be introduced after Congress comes back from recess after Labor Day. What do you think the chances are of this legislation actually moving forward, either in this Congress or in the next Congress? And who are the opponents of equal pay?
Well, I think the chances of it moving this Congress are limited. That being said, equal pay is enormously popular as an issue in the general public. It is popular among women. It's popular among men of all different races and ethnicities and economic levels. So it is in everybody's best interest to address equal pay. You rarely hear a member of Congress say they're against equal pay, but yet there has been a persistent lack of movement on this issue for many, many years. And there's nothing that we have seen to suggest that that stalemate will change in the next few months. You know, obviously the next Congress, we'll see what happens with the composition of Congress and whether or not that changes their motivations in terms of moving forward. You know, the opposition to equal pay is, I think, sometimes a little bit of a moving target. There are some who question whether or not it's a problem and would like to just simply say that pay differences are really just about women's different choices. And then there are others who say, well, they want to, you know, we have laws and that's enough. We don't need to do any more. And then there are a few who have offered alternative bills that in the view of many won't really move the ball forward. So the opposition sort of, you know, comes up in a variety of different settings. But you know, the bottom line, I think, from the perspective of those who really want to enforce equal pay protections, is that we need to take whatever steps are necessary to ensure that folks have the protections that they need, that we minimize pay discrimination wherever it's occurring, and that we explore the range of policies that are needed to really help close the wage gap.
I'm speaking with Jocelyn Fry. She is a senior fellow with the Women's Initiative here at the Center for American Progress. And we're speaking about equal pay and, in particular, legislation that will be introduced after Congress returns from its recess that would prohibit employers from asking about salary histories. Jocelyn, our listeners may remember that the first piece of legislation that President Obama signed upon assuming the presidency was the Lilly Ledbetter Act. Remind us what the Lilly Ledbetter Act did and why, in the wake of that legislation, we still need to see further progress on these issues.
Well, the Lilly Ledbetter Act was an incredibly important piece of legislation that the president signed in 2009. What it did was regain ground that had been lost because of a negative Supreme Court decision. A few years earlier, in 2007, the Supreme Court ruled against Lilly Ledbetter, who's now become incredibly well known as a pay fairness advocate. Lilly Ledbetter had been discriminated against for years and didn't know that and discovered it. She sued and she won, and the employer appealed. And when it got to the Supreme Court, they basically said that she had run out of time to file her claim. And their decision effectively overturned 30 years of case law that had been very clear that as long as you experience discrimination each time you get a discriminatory paycheck, that qualifies as an act of discrimination, and you can bring a case. They said that the only decision that matters is the first decision to discriminate. So if you experience discrimination starting 20 years ago, you have 180 days to bring that case based on the first act of discrimination. That's what they said.
So effectively changing when the clock starts ticking.
Exactly right. And so that effectively would have made it nearly impossible for most people to bring pay discrimination claims. And it simply wasn't the way the law had operated before. It was largely untenable. And there was a lot of debate back and forth, and unfortunately there was a stalemate in the Senate in particular around the bill that was largely along partisan lines. And when the president came in, there was a change, both a changed climate and a changed composition. It led to the bill being sent to his desk and he signed it. So it was really important, but it's also important to understand that what it did was simply get people back to where they had been, as opposed to adding new protections to strengthen laws to make them even stronger than they had been over the past few years. So the Ledbetter law was important, but it didn't really address the problem that we have now, which is that even with equal pay laws, the equal pay laws that we've had, there are still gaps in protections, and we need stronger protections, such as the salary history provision or making sure that employers can't require people to be secretive about their pay. Those sorts of provisions we haven't had in place and are really critical to creating workplaces that are free of discrimination.
You mentioned that the realistic chances of this bill actually moving in this Congress are, I think the word you chose was limited, which
yes.
was wonderful exercise of diplomacy, considering the political climate. And we have to see where the chips are going to fall later this year before we know what the next Congress is going to look like. But for those reasons, many folks have turned their eyes to the states. And as of now, Massachusetts is the only state in the nation where asking about salary history is prohibited. That law passed in early August, the bill that became the law passed in early August. But comparable laws are also being considered in New York City, the state of New York, California, and Colorado, possibly others as well. What do you think the future is of state progress on this issue?
Well, I think it's promising. As you mentioned, there are a number of states who have been talking about these issues, and we'll certainly see what happens in the fall in particular. What we've seen, though, is that the states have tended to be more progressive and more collaborative on these issues. And the Massachusetts bill is the latest example. There was a diverse coalition on the ground. It had bipartisan support. It was signed by a Republican governor. Last year, a year and a half ago, there was a bill in California, also very progressive, also had bipartisan support, including some support from the business community. So I think we have seen the states as a real laboratory for success. And I think that we will see that success continue, because the reality is that these problems matter. Pay discrimination and ensuring equal pay for equal work are huge priorities for people across the country. And they tell that to their policymakers at home, in their communities, and in their states, and nationally. And I think there is a need and a feeling that policymakers need to be responsive. And so you are seeing this growing amount of activity and interest on the ground, and that's a good thing.
And in the last minute that I have with you, you mentioned that prohibiting the asking of salary histories and the related common sense provision of not permitting employers to prohibit discussing your pay. So pay secrecy provisions are not a panacea, that they need to go along with a broader agenda to really secure progress on these issues. If you had to pick three policies besides the ones we've spoken about today that we need to see on the table, what would they be?
Well, three is a small number, but I'll try. You know, the first is that we need a broader set of economic security policies like paid family leave, paid sick days, and more expanded access to affordable, high-quality child care. And I would put those three policy ideas on the table, mostly because what we know happens, and the other contributor to the wage gap, is that women tend to work fewer hours across the board. And they do that because they're disproportionately more likely to be responsible for caring for their families. And so if we had those policies in place, you would create greater opportunity for women to stay in the workforce longer, retain jobs rather than leave their jobs, and continue on a course of growing and raising their wages. So those policies are really critical to the conversation about closing the wage gap.
I've been speaking with Jocelyn Fry. She's a senior fellow with the Women's Initiative at the Center for American Progress and former deputy assistant to President Obama and director of policy for First Lady Michelle Obama. Jocelyn, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with Talk Poverty Radio.
Well, thank you for having me, and it was great to be here.
You've got us 24 hours a day on your mobile smartphone via the Progressive Voices app. This is the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn.
Hi, I'm Gianna Garrell from Progressive Voices. Today, the angry roar of the conservative media machine dominates TV and radio, threatening to drown out and push out anyone who dares to discuss our progressive perspectives and ideals. But we can't let that happen. We have too many strong, smart, and important progressive voices who need to be heard. That's why here at PV, we're building a 21st century progressive media universe. One where all the best in progressive media can come together, rise above the static and the noise, and be heard by anyone, anywhere. And we need your help. We're in the middle of a critical campaign to make our dream of 21st century progressive media universe a reality. But we can't do it without grassroots support from people like you. Head over to progressivevoices.com to see how you can help. Please support this important progressive mission, because with your help, we can make sure all our progressive voices are heard.
Welcome back to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis. EpiPens are a matter of life and death for people with severe food and other allergies. But because of recent pricing decisions by Mylan, the company that acquired EpiPens in 2007, this product has become so expensive that many people, even people with health insurance, can't afford them when they need them. With me to discuss EpiPen Gate, that's what we're going to call it, folks, is Director of Health Policy here at the Center for American Progress, Maura Carlson, and Alex Lawson, the Executive Director of Social Security Works, among many other things, including being the owner of WEACT Radio. And Alex, I will spare you the back and forth of whether you're my boss or I'm your boss. Our listeners have heard it before. They know how it goes. We'll just have to agree to disagree. Thank you both for joining Talk Poverty Radio.
Thanks for having us.
So, Maura, I want to start off with you. People have been probably hearing a lot about EpiPens in the news lately. They've been everywhere, it seems, and EpiPen Gate is making headlines. What are EpiPens? Why are they so important?
Well, as you said, they are really a matter of life or death for people with severe food and other allergies. And essentially, they are a spring-loaded tube of epinephrine, which is basically just the hormone adrenaline. And essentially how they're designed is you just take the spring-loaded tube and you can easily jab it into your thigh in order to prevent very extreme response to allergies, anaphylactic shock, which is basically a life-threatening whole-body allergic reaction. And people with severe allergies are supposed to carry EpiPens with them everywhere they go.
So how did we get to the point where EpiPens have become so expensive? Walk us through the steps here. And as you and I were actually talking about before we started taping, this is not actually a new problem. It's just one that has gained recent attention.
Right, absolutely. And I think that the key thing for listeners to remember is the reason why EpiPens are so expensive is because of pricing decisions that Mylan Pharmaceuticals has made. And essentially, Mylan purchased this product in 2007, and since then, they have gone up in price almost 500%. They're sold essentially usually in two packs, I believe, and they used to cost about $100 for a two pack, and now they're $600 for a two pack.
And $100 is a lot for
yes.
two shots that you need, especially when you consider that the actual drug, the active drug in these EpiPens, it costs somewhere between $1 to $5 to actually purchase to put in the pens.
Exactly. This is not a new drug. This is a drug that's been around for decades.
So you mentioned pricing decisions, but sort of walk me through that. What does that mean? How can a company make decisions that jack up the price of a product by 500%?
Well, basically drug companies have complete latitude to charge what they want to charge. And because these are life-saving, people don't have a choice. They have to pay the amount that Mylan says that they have to pay.
So it's sort of a hostage consumer base, and this is the consequence. So Alex Lawson, I want to bring you in here, and I know you are fired up on EpiPen Gate. So, what do we need to know about what's going on with Mylan and the significance of their pricing decisions here?
So I think A couple additional points that I think should jack up the outrage even more is that
it's what you do for us. You jack up the outrage.
Is that the EpiPen was produced for the Department of Defense. It was actually produced with public taxpayer dollars. It was called the CombiPen, and it was produced actually as a rapid delivery system for epinephrine as a rapid delivery system for an antidote to nerve toxins that soldiers could carry around with them that did not require a syringe and a vial of medicine, et cetera, right? So that's why the EpiPen was developed, again, by public tax dollars. So it was the CombiPen for DOD, the EpiPen for civilian use. So I just want everyone to remember that aspect of it, that we paid to develop the device as well. The drug itself was first patented, I think, in 1890, or at least the patent 1907 or 1890, not that it's a big difference. Very old drug.
So Maura, I think you've been vindicated. It is not a new drug by those standards. Okay.
And the device was developed by, public dollars. But now I want to get to my favorite buzzword on the show, which is how do the greedy liars on Wall Street fit in here? Because that's what people need to understand. The pharmaceutical industry as it is right now and their pricing power and their ability to just jack up the prices as much as they want, that is not at all actually connected to any sort of innovation or invention or anything like that. It is actually seen as a banking product. It's just one more place where these greedy liars on Wall Street, like hedge fund billionaire Paulson, who actually is heavily invested in Mylan. So what they do is they control these companies. They push them not to innovate, not to invent things, but to find patents that they see as quote unquote undervalued, and then to buy those companies or acquire the rights like Mylan did in 2007, and then jack up the price as high as they can. And anyone who's studied economics knows that the monopoly price is literally as high as the market will bear. But here is where there's this huge problem with our current setup. How much would a parent pay to save the life of their child, right? It is the monopoly plus that lead to this behavior that is completely reprehensible and repugnant, that everyone is recognizing. Now, the thing is, EpiPen is it's not one company, it's not one price. EpiPen is just the latest. But this is system-wide, and that's why, I think we're going to get to that we need systemic reform on this. But just one quick one. Mind-bogglingly, insulin. Insulin, again, over 100 years old, insulin is now seen. So there's a critical medication for
people with diabetes.
With diabetes. Type 1 diabetes. This is children who, you know, there's no lifestyle choices that can do anything about it. They need insulin to live. If they don't have insulin, they will die. How much will a parent pay? Obviously, to their last penny. The price has increased 3,000%. Okay, this is a drug that's over 100 years old. There's no innovation or invention that these prices are going into. This is just price gouging.
Now, you mentioned the financial motive underpinning all of this, right? And that's, I think, obvious, but I think worth putting some numbers to it. You've both discussed how Mylan acquired EpiPen in 2007. At that time, when you look at the numbers, the company had just $200 million in revenue. I say just as though that's a small amount of money, but that at that point, they had $200 million in revenue. Now that they have this $1 billion-a-year product that is providing almost half, 40% of the company's operating profits, they are now seeing massive, massive financial returns. The CEO has seen her salary increase during that time from about $2.5 million a year to almost $19 million a year since 2007, and the company's stock has tripled. So Alex, you're talking about this as really, this isn't, these medicines, these life-saving medicines have become a financial product.
Right. That's what I was looking for, the financialization of them, so that these are just, you know, like an exchange traded funds, or it turns people's health into a profit center for companies to exploit, but more importantly, for the money behind the companies to exploit. And if you look at actually the CEO of Mylan's pay package, it's important that the incentives that are in there will continue to lead her to jack up the price of EpiPen forever, because it's, you know, they give her stock options that will vest at a certain point. And that means that her whole goal is actually to increase the stock price of the company. That is the definition of short-term gain for long-term disaster, right? That's penny-wise, pound-foolish, as we've seen time and time again. Companies that actually invest in their future, they don't stay focused on the stock prices. They don't go quarter to quarter on the stock prices. The ones that do that is when what the companies become are actually just a way for the CEO and the other executives to make tens of millions of dollars. Just one little thing. Mylan also inverted so that they pay almost no taxes in America. And when they did that as part of that deal, because this is all about these Wall Street deals.
And when you say inverted, you're talking about corporate inversion. Explain what that means.
Man, I would swear if I could, but it is just a BS.
It's a tax strategy.
Yes.
It's a tax evasion strategy.
It's a BS tax strategy, though, because it used to be fully illegal, right? I mean, like, and that it moved to like, oh, no, now this is just the way business is. This is not the way business is done. This is the way business is done when the system has been rigged in favor of Wall Street, because what they're basically saying is, even though it's an American company, even though they use American courts, they rely on American laws, when they're in trouble, when these companies are in trouble, they go to the Department of Justice seeking help. They are an American company, but they say, oh, well, we're just going to kind of locate in Ireland so that we don't have to pay any taxes.
Right.
When they did that, the CEO made something around $30 million, right? And just, I want people to really understand all these tens of millions of dollars so they get it. This CEO, this company is willing to hold hostage the health of children so that their executives can make millions of dollars. And that is not business.
So Maura, bringing you back in here. So Mylan responded because there's been a lot of criticism for the price gouging that's happening on EpiPenGate here. What was Mylan's response? Did they accept the blame or what did they do?
No, I think what's actually interesting about Mylan's response is it's sort of a a perfect show and tell of pharmaceutical PR strategies to make themselves look like they're looking out for patients when they're really just looking out for profits. So the first thing they did was they said that they would release a generic for about half that price. And I mean, I think that that just
puts it at $300 for a generic.
Yeah, we're still talking $300. And it also is just ridiculous, right? That there is a company that holds the patent rights, but then can also do what's called an authorized generic. It just shows how completely bizarre U.S. laws with regards to patent and monopolies. And then it also said, in addition to releasing that, and there are some issues involved with that, because first of all, it doesn't do anything. I'll get back to the problems with the generics. But the other thing they did was they have a coupon program now. So essentially, they're saying to patients, oh, don't worry about these costs. We'll give you a coupon. And I think that Senator Warren actually described coupons in the best way I've heard it. She calls it a complex shell game. Because essentially what the coupons do is they hold the parents or the other patients harmless, but they don't pay for the entire drug. So we're all still paying for part of this drug. Your employer's paying for it if you have employer-sponsored insurance, Medicare, Medicaid, whatever other insurance you have.
They're just squeezing the balloon.
Exactly. And then what does that do? That increases everybody's premium. So we're still all supporting Mylan. We're still all paying for these crazy prices. It's just very much a hide-and-seek game, so you can't really see exactly what's going on. And, you know, these are, and again, I think the theme is yes, everybody's talking about EpiPens right now, but these are such typical responses, and especially the coupons. And, you know, they're great for consumers, and, you know, they do very much help people. They also, what they do is they make the generic less attractive to people, because if people can still get an EpiPen and the brand name EpiPen using their coupon, they'll still do that. So they'll still be passing along some of that money to the whole system versus if they are buying the cheaper generic.
So now the company also, in the course of this shell game and PR stunt that you've just described, they also tried to blame the rising costs on the Affordable Care Act. How did they try to shift that blame? And is there any truth there?
No, it's completely inaccurate, and it's just so disingenuous. I mean, the Affordable Care Act has made it possible for more people to buy their products, and it's just ridiculous that they would blame the Affordable Care Act. Now, there is a trend more generally in the insurance market, and it's not just in the plans offered through the ACA's marketplaces, but it's also, I'm sure a lot of the listeners know that if they receive insurance through their employers, for example, they have really big deductibles now, and there's sort of a cost shift to consumers.
And there is actually increased use of high deductible plans.
Exactly. And that's not because of the Affordable Care Act. It's in large part because trying to keep premiums low. But anyhow, part of the issue is that if you have a massive deductible and the EpiPen, you haven't met the deductible before the EpiPen comes out, you're going to have to pay the entire price out of pocket.
But that doesn't explain the rising cost of the product itself.
No, not at all. Not at all. Not at all. And like I went back to before, I think that rising high deductible costs have made more people aware of these prices. And drug companies love to talk about capping deductibles. They love to say, oh, it's the big bad insurers. And they love to say, oh, it's not us, just your insurance makes you pay too much of this. But that's just one part of the problem. And meaningful, comprehensive drug pricing reform needs to lower the overall prices of these products and then also make sure that employers and insurers pass that savings along to consumers.
So let's talk about a little bit about solutions here, because we have a lot of them. And there's been a lot of discussion in the press and now actually coming out in the presidential debate around what can we do, what should we be doing, not just on EpiPens, but more broadly on drug pricing. Alex, tell us a little bit about kind of broadly how EpiPen fits into a broader drug pricing crisis. What is the drug pricing crisis we face here? And is there anything already on the books that we could be doing to address it?
I want to try to get it to be as simple as possible. And I've come up with my phrase on it, which is just that the problem is drug prices are too high. That's it. That's what
Alex,
it is.
Alex, that's still too complicated.
Drug
Can you distill it a little further?
Are too high. Now, their first tactic these corporations, these drug corporations, is to blame someone, anyone else. The insurer, Obamacare, Medicare, whoever.
FDA.
Whoever it is. FDA, they just point their finger, right? It's not us. But the thing is, there is only one culprit here, and it is the drug corporations. They can charge whatever they want and get away with it. And it's pricing power. That's what comes with their monopolies. There is nothing underlying these price increases, which are about 10% a year. Right? In a real functioning market, if there's a price increase, you look under it and you say, oh, well, the things that this is made out of have gone up.
Right.
And that's why the price increased. Well,
you go to Chipotle, they say your burrito is now going to cost a little more if you get it with guacamole because the price of avocados has gone up. Right. That would make sense.
So here's this. And I will get to solutions, which is the important part. But this is sometimes shocking to people when they hear it. But you really should really understand that drugs are actually incredibly cheap. They cost pennies, literally pennies. The molecules themselves cost pennies, and that is not changing. The price of the EpiPen, the price of epinephrine has not gone up. The price of the EpiPen has not gone up. The price of in that Gilead charges for the cure for hepatitis C, which is one of the most repugnant ones out there right now, nothing has changed there. It's not like there's underlying inflation. It is just pricing power.
So what's changing is the profits of these companies.
Exactly. That's it. It's just greed driven. Okay. So that is why it's important to understand that with the solutions, so that you get that there's multiple ways of going after this, but all solutions need to be focused on the underlying problem, which is monopolies. Now, sometimes there's collusion and price rigging. So there might be three companies that are all raising prices together. But the underlying pricing power, because we don't want to get into a situation where you're restricting access, that people need these drugs and you're restricting access. But as long as you're focused on the monopoly, as long as you understand the problem is just driven by drug corporation greed, then the solutions become apparent.
We're on Talk Poverty Radio here speaking with Alex Lawson and Maura Kalson about EpiPenGate and now more broadly drug pricing and what we can do to bring these prices down. But let's turn to solutions. So, and Maura, you wanted to get in here.
Right. I think that before we talk about solutions, I want to just flag something that Alex said earlier when he talked about the government investment in developing EpiPens. And I think it's important for our listeners to know that this is actually the case with many, many drugs. And taxpayers and government involvement in developing many, many, many products is just a constant theme throughout the entire industry, that the government funds what's called basic research, looking at how different functions of the body works. And then drug companies take that research that we've invested in and then use it to develop their own products. And, you know, each stage of the research process is important, but there's a massive government investment in research that then the pharmaceutical industry is able to monetize. And we also help underwrite their R&D. We help underwrite their marketing. And it's just there's a big, big, big story to be told about how taxpayers really at every single stage of drug development and marketing, we help them. And I think that that's an important piece as we start to talk about solutions, because some of those levers can be used to try to rein in some of the drug companies.
And as you describe this, I'm thinking back to the famous President Obama speech of "You didn't build that," right? Trying to have a conversation about what does tax fairness look like in this country, and whether tax fairness is, as opponents of those kinds of policies would claim, siphoning money away from rich people who happen to be so successful that they earned that money. The same is often said of corporations, but you're making the point that they're stepping on the shoulders of public investment that gets the products to where they are. Alex, you wanted to get in here as well.
I feel like we need a whole other show, and we should have it. This is my pitch.
Well, you are my boss.
Just on this one concept, and because it's so important to understand, I want to talk about the act that what we're working on, but there's these fundamental things that once the public understands this, everything will change. When we lower drug prices, when drug prices lower, we are going to have more innovation. We are going to have more invention, more cures, more treatments.
Well, break that down for us, right? Because I think it might sound like common sense, the conventional wisdom that, oh, these companies, they're spending all this money on research and development. It's really expensive to come up with these important drugs. Shouldn't they have patent protection in a way that they can make their money back? Why is that not true?
Oh, I was going to say, I have two problems with that. One is we don't really know how much they spend on R&D. It's just a black box.
Why don't we know?
Because they don't have to release it. So
because they spend billions of dollars promoting their narrative that it is all R&D. But the thing is, it's not. We've had some understanding of what's underlying it. EpiPen, because, you know, that we do get every once in a while, the overreach is so great. Their greed is so great that they choke on it. And then we get a little bit of documents and we see that there's nothing underlying the prices. But the reason that lowering drug prices will increase innovation and invention and cures and treatments is because right now the pharmaceutical corporations are actually only competing in this very financialized way, right? So attaining market exclusivity from whatever way they can, whether it's patent-based or whether it's, you know, building up barriers through a variety of mechanisms. Mylan, for example, you could have an alternative EpiPen, but they've made it incredibly difficult. And they do that by just turning fire hoses of cash to this town and buying people in this town.
This town being Washington,
D.C. The well-heeled lobbyists that everyone pictures on the Hill, those are all, they all work for pharma. They spend the most money on lobbying of any industry because that is their industry.
They're the ones wearing the monocles and the top hats, right?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, okay.
They have to. And they have little canes. They walk around. They twist their mustache and they're like, ha, ha, ha. But
except the ones who dress like pirates you've emulated in the past.
These pharma bros are actually competing not with creating new cures or new treatments or finding new ways of doing things. They're only competing in this financialized Wall Street way, which is acquiring a patent and jacking up. So they spend all their time actually researching what patents do other companies hold that they think are undervalued.
Market share.
Now, if you, exactly, because it's all about protecting their monopoly. If you actually produce a system where people are competing on the products, right, on the inventions, on the innovations, and you reward patents and you reward monopolies based on innovation and invention, right? So this takes a slight refiguring of our system that will increase. Here, I can make it really easy. Why are there so many drugs that look like Viagra, right? Why are there a multitude of drugs for like Viagra, and yet we haven't seen any developments on malaria stuff in far too long? We haven't seen really groundbreaking research into tuberculosis treatments in far too long. Well, because the market incentive right now is fully aimed at these blockbuster drugs like Viagra, these lifestyle drugs that you can advertise during NFL games and you can make enormous amounts of money on. Viagra, good. I'm glad Viagra exists. It should exist. But we don't need seven different versions of it. And the industry shouldn't always be basically, they're called Me Too drugs, where you're just looking at the successful drugs of your competitors and building the exact same thing. That does not advance the public health.
Or erecting it, as the case may be. Maura, you wanted to get in here.
Sorry, that was unfair as a transition. Couldn't resist.
No, so I'm going to just put that aside.
We're going to move on from that one.
I think, you know, you hear drug lobbyists and you hear the drug corporations talk about innovation all the time. It's their favorite word, innovation, innovation, innovation. But innovation doesn't, you know, just because something's new doesn't make it innovative. If it's a Me Too drug, it's not truly innovative. So I think that that's a really, and I think that that's a powerful scare tactic that they use for the American public. Like, if you take away our huge profits, we won't be able to innovate. We won't come up with something new. And in addition to really not having a handle on how much they're spending on R&D, I think a lot of people don't realize when a new drug comes out, it is completely just approved on the basis of its comparison to a placebo. So there's no real comparison between treatments that are out there. And there is information out there right now, but the U.S. isn't really getting it, and there needs to be a lot more of that kind of comparative research between two different drugs so people know what works better.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm speaking with Alex Lawson and Maura Kalson about EpiPenGate and drug pricing, what we can do about this. So now let's actually get to solutions. And Alex, I think you know we keep an office pool about how many times you're going to say greedy liars on Wall Street, and I've won because I had the highest guess.
Yes, always was, guess high on that one.
It was
one.
Price is Right rules. But talking about solutions, we were actually just speaking before we started this segment about the fact that there actually are levers, policy levers that the federal government has available. They exist on the books, no legislation needed to do something about this. What are those levers and why aren't they being used?
So there's a whole bunch of them. And some of the things that I'm going to talk about, we don't know if they're going to work because they've never been tried, but they exist. These powers, which are called executive authority, right? It's executive power. It exists in the executive arm. So you have these agencies like the FDA, you have the NIH, you have these arms of government that have existing authority that can be used to advance their goals. So let me give you one example. In April, President Obama put forward an executive order that instructed, and I don't want to do too much Schoolhouse Rock here, but
I think it's useful.
It instructed the executive agencies, which includes the FDA, which is under HHS. And the executive order also says, hey, independent agencies, which actually don't flow directly from the executive office.
And the FDA is important here. That's the Food and Drug Administration.
Yes. FDA is not an independent agency. FDA is under HHS. HHS has a cabinet secretary, right? That's kind of how you can see it. The order said, do everything within your power that is legal to increase competition. And it said, here, if you note places where there is a non-competitive market, use the power that you have to increase competition. Now, in the case of EpiPen, you can very clearly see how the FDA could take action to increase competition. There are alternatives to the EpiPen. They have been kept off the market for a variety of reasons. FDA has pulled one off the market. FDA has kept another one off the market. I'm not saying that anything should get pushed through. There should always be rigorous testing. At the same time, FDA should actually say, why does EpiPen have 94% of the market? Let's look at the Teva alternative. Let's look at I don't want to go too into the weeds because none of these corporations are good guys. Mm-hmm. It's important to note that.
The point being, if one company has 94% of the market, how does that not
right.
raise alarm bells?
And so they can do things to actually encourage competition. And then they can do things to say, oh, and even if there is competition, if y'all are acting in collusion, if you're price rigging the system, then other agencies, we have agencies that specifically look at that, right? Antitrust stuff. They can come in and say, that is illegal because it is illegal.
So why is this not happening?
Because put a pin in that for a second because
we're never going to get there.
No, we're going.
Next episode, we're going to find out why this isn't happening. Yeah.
We are starting to see it. That's it, and it's really exciting and important because EpiPen really made people see this. There are some other ones, though, and that's why I just said put a pin in it for a second because there's some very interesting ones around patents. Mm. Retrospectively, so patents that already exist, there's a few ideas that you can use government authority. There's one called Section 1498, which the government has used primarily DOD in buying things like night vision goggles. They just say, we're going to buy all these. We're going to produce them. They're patented, but we're just going to buy them. We're going to produce our own versions, and then we're just going to pay this company, basically saying, we don't have to follow your patent. We gave you the patent. That's the key understanding. Patents are not universal and unlimited.
And inviolable, right?
They come from the government. So the government has the ability under 1498. It's been used actually during the anthrax attack in 2000 and 2001. The Bush Department threatened the use of 1498 on Bayer. And Bayer actually came to an agreement to so that they wouldn't do that because they didn't want to show that if you break the monopolies, the price goes down. That's one. There's existing law, the Bayh-Dole law. There's kind of two ways of interpreting this. There's one that says if the price is unreasonable, you can have these Marchin rights, which would just allow the production of an alternative to that. That's system-wide. I like that one.
Would think that $600 for two life-saving pens when the medicine inside of them costs a total of $10 at most would be, quote, unreasonable.
I should also point out that has been produced with public dollars.
Oh, okay.
So which the EpiPen is part of.
Oh, okay. So that would work here.
Yes-ish. The FDA stuff would work better on EpiPen than this. This would mm-hmm. work well for the Gilead, for the Hep C drugs, because that's just only the patent is what's keeping that monopoly. So that Marchin writes broadly. There's also another school of thought that says you could do a similar thing with Bayh-Dole, but it'd only be for government systems. So it would be for the 50% of our healthcare that is provided in a public manner. So Medicare, VA, all of those that they could get alternatives.
So Alex, in the 5 minutes that we have left, mm-hmm. I actually do want to get to why these powers and many others that you could probably mention are not being used. And then I also want to bring Maura back in to talk about how we could go farther than what's on the books and what types of legislative ideas are being discussed.
But Alex, change the books.
So why are these not being used? And then we'll change over.
It's really simple that it's just because it hasn't been done before. I mean, I'm not gonna say it's easy either, because these corporations have so much money. They will sue. They will fight. They will, right? So, like, that is part of it, and they are powerful if you're retrospectively doing things. But one of the things I want to kind of leave this with, because I'm just filibustering a little bit, is that you can also prospectively do a lot of things. You can say for all future patents, here are some restrictions we're going to put on so that this never happens again. And then I want to close in saying we've been at Social Security Works working with a whole grip of allies, including Center for American Progress, on a raft of ideas, including some of this stuff in the executive action side. And we note this is new. This is a new place for people to go. But just today, Hillary Clinton acknowledged that these powers do exist. We don't exactly know what shape it's going to take, but we do know that the executive can take action to lower drug prices. So if you remember, the problem is drug prices are too high. And then the answer is we're going to have a bunch of legislation, but also because Congress is probably not going to move with a clarity, we're also going to say the executive can act to lower drug prices.
Alex Lawson with the SAT words there. So, Maura, in the last couple of minutes that we have here, so there already are policies on the books that are not being taken advantage of, as we've now heard, to bring drug prices down and to introduce more competition into the market. But there also has been discussion in Congress about taking steps even further. What types of ideas are being discussed? What types of legislation might we see in the coming weeks, months, years?
Well, I think the two pieces that you hear a little bit more about day to day when you're talking to policymakers up on the Hill is let's try to shine some light on what the drug companies are actually doing. Let's see, you know, let us actually verify your claims that you are spending all of this amazing time, money, energy on R&D. So really asking them to specify in much more detail exactly how much of their profits then go channeled back into R&D. So transparency, you think it's just a basic concept, but it just scares the drug industry to death. So I think that, you know, that's a pretty good sign that I think that, you know, lifting up the hood and taking a look, we're going to see some stuff that we suspect is there, but we don't know.
So a little bit of sunlight.
Exactly. And also the same thing is when I was talking about comparing two drugs with each other. I think that there's a lot of thinking going on right now about how do we force drug companies to really show that their drug works better in order to get a higher price. And there's just not any of that. There's not a lot of that information out there right now. And then, you know, there's things that I'm sure everybody's heard about before, like Medicare negotiation and some pieces like that.
Well, it's actually, in the minute that we have left, talk a little bit about that, because we haven't discussed the, one of the major pillars of this whole set of issues, which is the fact that Medicare, within Medicare, negotiation on prices is extremely limited. Alex, give us the 101.
So Medicare is not allowed to negotiate drug prices because pharma bought off a bunch of people in Congress and some outside organizations to allow that to happen. I wanted to jump in here to say Medicare negotiating drug prices is not far enough. That is not even, that had to be done 9 years ago.
But it's a modest step that actually never has even been taken, and most people aren't even aware of.
Exactly. We have to have that, but we need to go much further than that. What I would say is that the VA, which is the only part of our healthcare system that does negotiate, and the negotiation looks like this: company, I'm going to pay you X. Done. That's what we need. We need to import the VA prices into Medicare and into other parts of our system. And then I think in the end, to the entire healthcare system at large.
The VA being the Department of Veterans Affairs. Mara, take us out with some last thoughts.
I just think that there's something going on up on the Hill right now that just shows how difficult this is. Medicare is trying to do a very small experiment on some types of drugs to try to lower their prices. And pharma has brought out all of, taken out all stops, is just completely flooding the Hill. And, you know, now even if the administration is trying to do something small, Congress is threatening to come in and just undermine that. And that's just a minuscule piece of this, but it just shows what pharma is like and what we're up against.
Well, you heard it here first. I have a patent on the term EpiPen Gate, and so everyone who uses that is going to have to pay me massive royalties. I hope it gets to $19 million soon. Alex Lawson is the executive director of Social Security Works and the owner of We Act Radio, and one of the people we bring on to jack up the outrage. Maura Kalson is the director of health policy at the Center for American Progress. Thanks to you both, and happy Labor Day.
Happy Labor Day.
Thank you.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening to Talk Poverty Radio, broadcasting from the heart of Anacostia in Washington, D.C. You can catch us weekends at 11 a.m. on the We Act Radio Network. You can also catch us Saturdays, 11 a.m., and Sundays at 10 a.m. on the Progressive Voices Network via the TuneIn app.
You can also subscribe to Talk Poverty Radio as a podcast via iTunes. And feel free to pitch us on Twitter at the handle @TalkPoverty or email us at info@talkpoverty.org. See you next week.